So our next speaker is Annette Mikes. Annette is no stranger to the LSE. She did her PhD here. She then went to a lesser institution, the Harvard Business School, where she was for 7 years. And for the past 2 years, she's joined HEC in Lausanne as Professor of Management Control. Her area of interest has always centered around financial institutions, risk, and culture. And she's put out sort of very, very interesting articles around those areas. Some of her work is more empirical than others. I think today you'll get a good sense of that. But she also writes quite a lot about man-made disasters. Women don't sort of cause disasters, but she'll tell us a little bit about that. So join me in welcoming Annette.
Thank you. Thank you for this really, really warm reception. When I came here this morning, I was just in a reflective mode, and I thought, it's 2016. What was I doing in 2006, 10 years ago? Well, I was finishing off a long, prolonged journey that's called a PhD. And secondly, at this time that year, we had a MARC conference, and I was a PhD student, nominated or volunteered, as Simon's term was, volunteered by Al and Michael to write up the synopsis of this conference. So I trust there is a similar PhD student in this room as well. Is there anyone still doing that? There you go. So this talk is dedicated to you guys. I know what you're going through, and I also know that this might be a bit of a predictor. So ask yourself, maybe in 10 years' time, it's going to be you talking here. Maybe Al and Michael have already got plans for you as well. So it's a rite of passage. Okay, so the talk that I was asked to do is one where I felt I have got no particular core competencies. I've been dabbling in issues of risk management, and I went as far as once coining the term for calculative cultures, but that's all the distance I try, that's all I could get to culture, because culture is a term that at LSE, at least in the past when I was a doctoral student here, at LSE they treat this term very, very carefully. So unless you have got a very solid grounding in organizational theory, it's kind of an academic suicide to start working with culture. Then I went to the Harvard Business School, where culture was kind of a currency of common language. It is a very much used, loved, and even overused term there, and everybody there thinks that they can affect culture. They can manage culture, they can design culture, and so on. So I'm coming from these two traditions, but I'm still ambivalent on this subject. There is a sort of idea of cultural determinism, and there is an idea of cultural managerialism. And the reason why this is affecting me is that in the new emergent discourse of risk cultures, we see both of these viewpoints. And so this might be one of the reasons why this is still a very much contested area, and it's interesting to talk about. So when Michael and Al had the idea that maybe someone should talk about this, I took this on with a caveat emptor. I haven't done any research on risk culture per se, but I'm intrigued by the discourse that has developed around it. One reason for that is, as I mentioned, culture as a term has a long-standing hold on management scholarship. And people say that it's most useful when it actually helps us explain some hard-to-understand, inexplicable phenomena in organizations or in management. Ed Schein, who is the former scholar or most cited organizational scholar on the subject, has been quoted on this and has been brought back to relevance because one of the most mind-boggling and incomprehensible phenomena that occurred was the financial crisis. And how could it be that risk management conscious organizations that claimed they had been developing risk management systems for a long time got into such a trouble? the risk culture discourse doesn't limit itself on financial services. When Deepwater Horizon happened, blew up in the face of BP managers, you might say, that was, I think, in the middle of the financial crisis, that immediately triggered the discourse around safety cultures and risk cultures around BP. So culture is back. We don't understand why these corporate disasters are happening. And a lot of people say, as a kind of reaction, it has something to do with bad cultures. So on that note, there is a very interesting research project that was started here at the London School of Economics by my former advisor, Mike Power, and his colleague, Tommaso Palermo. Tommaso is actually sitting here. If I wasn't here, you should be doing this, really, or you should be helping me with this, because you are the expert on this. So they are doing this study. They have been doing this study for quite a few years now. And I think both reports they have produced are extremely interesting, so I would like to refer you to that. The report actually raises many, many rich questions that just is indicative of the interesting nature of this field. But one interesting quote from this is how they perceptively link the risk culture debate to an already existing phenomenon culture. So you guys have been saying that risk culture is theoretically not that different from what we already knew as culture. Having said that, a cottage industry has sprung up around the notion of risk culture. So there are some people who feel it's something that could be managerialized independently of culture. So Tommaso and Mike Power and Simon Ashby, who work on this report, are drawing question marks around the feasibility and plausibility of this project, but nevertheless, they draw attention to it. It is happening. There are a lot of consultants who vest themselves in creating solutions for risk culture problems. And for us scholars, this is interesting for many reasons. There are tools, frameworks being produced, which have, as I have always attracted the attention of management accounting scholars. And also, there are claims for solutions being found. And also, this is a social phenomenon, the emergence of a new calculative practice, perhaps around the discourse of culture. So this is all work in progress. So what we're going to do, maybe to try to get a glimpse into it. As a pushback on the cottage industry around risk culture, this month, Harvard Business Review published a leading article by Jay Lorsch, Jay Lorsch of the Lawrence and Lorsch fame. Jay Lorsch is an emeritus professor in organizational behavior, and he notices what Mike Power and Tommaso and Simon noticed, that when organizations get into trouble, fixing the culture is usually the prescription. He goes as far as stating that culture is not the culprit. So he is calling for a step back from culture, and he is calling for a reorientation towards other variables that we are more used to operating with as management scholars or managers. And working on those variables will bring a culture change, for better or worse. But nevertheless, he is actually putting the emphasis back on business models. Managers' concerns should be business models. It should be the processes and the structures that they put in place. Culture will follow. So there is still this school out there. Now, I would like to give just a very, very brief overview of my understanding of people's uses of culture in the management literature, because, as I said, there is this swinging of the pendulum between determinism and managerialism. So one of the famous quotes in this field is being attributed to Peter Drucker about culture eating strategy for breakfast. Some people would go as far as saying for breakfast, lunch, and dinner also. the CEO of IBM was once quoted to say that culture is everything. That's what he learned in his career. So basically, these are notions about cultural determinism. However, they have some sort of relevance in this talk because, funnily enough, these people were not sociologists or anthropologists, but this cultural determinism has its pedigree in anthropological work. Ethnographers showed us that cultures are essentially immutable characteristics of groups, and they develop over a course of history. Now, organizational scholars have gone a long way from the original anthropological conception of culture, and they went as far as trying to conceptualize it as something that managers can affect, even though with difficulty. So there is a caveat emptor around it. I'm going to put up here a sort of fairly well-known definition of culture, because I think this might help us in thinking about what risk culture might be. So culture, on the one hand, is actually a two-pronged phenomenon, according to Ed Schein. It's partly about the shared assumptions, learning, and behaviors that organizations develop and stabilize over time. But the other side of this prong is something around values. The espoused values or credo of an organization that underlines certain behaviors. Now, out of this conception, then management academics started to talk about good cultures, bad cultures, strong cultures, weak cultures. And so the idea of developing cultures or improving risk cultures comes back to this managerialism of culture. Now, I just would like to point out, if somebody understands Schein a little bit more than I do, it would be nice to clarify this, but my feeling is that Schein is a bit vacillating between managerialism and determinism. So he keeps putting in the caveat emptor that we should avoid the superficial models of culture and we should still keep referring back to its anthropological origins. I remember this is something that's really difficult to manage, which I'm going to skip this slide. If you would like a little bit more detail about how anthropologists treat this notion, a group is a culture, and how management scholars are deviating from it by stating a group has a culture, then these are the authors for you to look a bit more into. Now, Ed Schein, as I said, can always attach the caveat emptor to managerial determinism on culture, but it's actually hard to do, and he is speaking from his own experience. So in his famous introduction to his last big summary book on culture, he talks about the two interventions that he tried to carry out as a consultant to companies, and in both cases he failed miserably. His assignment was some sort of organizational development, and basically he came away from both sites thinking, no matter what I did, essentially nothing changed in these organizations. Now, this was in the early days of developing the notion of culture. He was confronted by determinism, but he was also confronted by his own lack of understanding of the most stable aspects of culture, which are around a group's shared assumptions or accumulated shared learning. So he basically conditions us, researchers and also managers, to understand that maybe there is some optimism, we can change cultures, but we better bear it in mind that we have to focus on things that we can actually loosen and be cautious about things that are unchangeable, immutable. Okay, so that's Ed Schein. We're going to say goodbye to him now. What I also take away from him is culture is a kind of moving target, so it evolves. So whenever you are observing an organization's culture, it's a kind of temporary landing space. Now, the reason I was drawing on Ed Schein's work is that it was kind of developed, or it flourished at the time when management accounting scholars decided to take on this subject. There are other works as well, of course, that could be relevant here. So I don't want to upset anyone by privileging two persons that, whose work I'm a little bit more familiar with. But I think they are good examples of how management accountants have cautiously, but quite deliberately, embraced the concept of culture. So many of you probably have read Jeremy Dent's classic study on the British Rail. This is kind of the first major encounter of a management accounting scholar with culture and cultural change affected by accounting. And then, of course, there is Harvard professor Bob Simons's canon, which is now building up to be a 15 years of work around the ideas of levers of controls, belief systems, boundary systems. Now, you don't find the word culture many times in Bob Simons' writing, but you do feel that it's all to do with culture, at least these two levers of controls. So we'll try to think a little bit further of what these management accounting works might teach us for us thinking about risk culture, if at all. So a little bit about Dent's study. I think it was still quite cautious about not trying to be either deterministic or managerialistic about culture. Culture was both something that accounting could affect and was also a manifestation. But the context for this is business model change. So still the idea is that when business models change, cultures change along with it. And I think this is generally the idea that drives other works as well, like Bob Simons's. His work is predicated on the idea of how to execute most efficiently strategies, business models. And so the notion is that many things need to be adjusted and fitted with the requirements of a strategy. So culture is one of those things. And the power of this kind of research is, of course, it's very empowering for accountants, because Simons and others would say accountants have a lot to do with this. We actually have the levers of control that can affect cultures. So another example for this is an email I have received from the Harvard Business School. You can guess who the writer is. The person is commenting on my little undertaking of writing about culture and management accounting research, and he's actually claiming, yes, we have everything to do with this. And Peter Drucker, with his notion of culture eats strategy for lunch, is a little bit of a person who is now outdated, because he didn't understand that we can control the levers of management control processes and measurements that, especially accounting scholars like us, can design and implement in organizations to create a new culture for a new strategy. So basically you can see the notion of it's accountants who can help top managers implement strategies by creating the right culture through the right processes, like, for example, the balanced scorecard. So by now you know that the author is Bob Kaplan. But instead of talking about his work, I'm still staying with Bob Simons, because he is the one who took the idea furthest by actually trying to convince us that the two levers of control, boundary systems and belief systems, are to do with culture. So just very briefly, for belief systems, basically he gives this definition, and what stands out of this is that it's all around values and purpose and actually formalizing those things in credos, mission statements, and core values. So the idea is that what management accountants can do, they can formalize some sentiments around values so they are not fluffy notions but part of formal systems that then we can control, or managers can affect, because we need those things to foster organizational commitment to business strategies. Now, the commitment is the thing that gives legitimacy to this lever, because one thing that he observed, taking from OB literature, incentive systems, the traditional preoccupation of accountants in trying to foster motivations in the right direction, he believes that incentive systems are actually not doing the job. They are not creating commitment, they are influencing behaviors, but commitment is created by inspirational and value-laden belief systems. So these are the levers of control of culture, although you wouldn't hear Bob Simons stating it in those terms. But these are the levers that will, for example, ensure that people do the right thing even when no one is watching formally. The quote is currently attributed to Bob Diamond, Barclays CEO, but actually it has a much longer pedigree, and it's been sort of popularized by Ivy Business School's leadership program 10 years ago. Now, one of the things that motivated this talk, and now we are moving to trying to understand what risk cultures might be, is this idea that belief systems don't seem to do their job, or they didn't in the financial services crisis. So I'm going to bring you an example. This is a lawsuit that was filed by a shareholder of Goldman Sachs called Eileen Richman against Goldman Sachs as the firm. And her claim was in 2011 that Goldman Sachs defrauded investors on the basis that it made statements about its conduct of business that proved to be misstatements in the light of the CDO mis-selling scandal and lawsuit and settlements and so on. So the statements in questions were things like, when Goldman Sachs reports and writes to investors who are putting money into Goldman Sachs shares, things like, this firm is about integrity, it's about honesty, it's about fair dealing, and so on, putting customers first. And Eileen Richman felt that the Goldman Sachs didn't live up to this, so these were misstatements. Now, the lawyers on behalf of Goldman attempted to convince the judge to drop this case on the basis, I quote, that the vast majority of the supposed misstatements alleged in the complaint regarding the firm's integrity and honesty are nothing more than classic puffery or statements of opinion, to which the judge concluded that if Goldman's arguments are Orwellian, if its claim of honesty and integrity are simple puffery, the world of finance may be in more trouble than we recognize. Now, the question for us, you know, the problem that we have, is this the problematic design and implementation of belief systems, or something bigger than that? Now, look at boundary systems. So these are, in a picture, a representation what delineate the space inside the opportunity space where employees should be operating, drawing the boundaries, the power of negative thinking. Don't do this, don't do that. What do we see in the financial services industry? We see a lot of cases for traders crossing boundaries like that. So we live the age of the demise of boundary systems as well. Now, from the man-made disasters literature, it's interesting to note that these kind of transgressions are rarely the doings of individual people. They occur in a certain organizational context that allows, so it's not about bad apples, but a bad barrel, which is why we now feel that what we feel was the failure of belief systems and boundary systems is actually a failure of something bigger. So now I start to understand why we need to address the idea of risk culture, which is basically, I think, the term given to the bigger picture, to the bad barrel. What makes that barrel bad? Then come Mike Power and Tommaso Palermo and Simon Ashby, and they start talking about the emergence of risk culture as a management object. But they show that this managerialization of risk culture is generally quite problematic, so there won't be an easy solution here. So I'm trying to do something outrageous and potentially career risking. I'm trying to get ahead of what empirics I do have and try to sort of talk about what I take away from this discourse about how we might think about risk culture. So there are two things here, I think. There are two types of discourses that go on. The first type of discourse concerns the importance of risks and risk management in the mindsets of the people who run these firms. So you could be a little bit more elegant and talk about shared assumptions, attitudes, practices, and values related to risks and risk management. Sociologically speaking, we are talking about risk objects. The things are threatening what? The strategy of the firm. So the object at risk is the strategy. That's the given. That's the business model part, and we are concerned about things that can jeopardize that. And if we are serious about this concern, then we have a strong risk culture. That's one kind of interpretation. The other kind of interpretation goes much further. It refocuses on not what is the threat, but what is at threat, what is at risk. So apart from strategy, which is the traditional concern for enterprise risk management, now the concern is broadening to values at risk, to the values that the company holds important, and so particularly when there is a pluralism of those values, there could be conflicting objectives which disguise conflicting values, so managers have to make trade-offs. These are going to be very tough decisions, and so the question is there a risk culture in place that tells them how to make these trade-offs? What values to privilege, which stakeholder to privilege when the push comes to shove? So along these two lines, we are essentially talking about two different aspects of culture. In this second case, not just about strategy at risk, but values at risk too. Okay, so to speak a little bit more about this, how we conceptualize this, recently I had been working with Bob Kaplan on an article that's sort of trying to deal with the moral deficiency of risk management decision making. And before I get there, I actually have to quote Mike Power. He didn't come, so he can't escape this. I'm going to put his picture up here, and I'm going to use him as the kind of inspiration for the first half of the definition. It's from this project that I've been talking about. At the end of the day, when you push him, what are you taking away? How would you define it? The answer he gave, at least on that YouTube link, is that culture is simply where the organization takes risk seriously. So he talks to the first definition, that, first part of the definition that I showed you. So taking risk seriously, that is what is at stake here at that level. And of course now most of us in the current cultural climate, and that's around financial services, we would say this is obvious, this is important. However, there are lots of sentiments traditionally and historically out there in business that risk management, knowing risks, can actually hinder innovation and creativity and entrepreneurship. So there are these two notions that are competing, the just do it, and the think. Okay, and the just do it has got some intellectual pedigree in the work of Albert Hirschman, the development economist, who talked about the principle of the hiding hand, and showed that in some cases, not knowing about risks can serve as a stimulus to enterprise. I'm not going to go through his work here, you can read a little bit more in the slides, but I have to be careful. I'm not going to try to trivialize his work, but he always pointed out this is under certain conditions. Certainly, he wouldn't have agreed that people in developed countries where there is a lot of overconfidence or confidence in their expertise would use the hiding hand principle and would just do it. Okay, so it's a kind of misuse or ill-use of the hiding hand when we hear sentiments that business, the risk managers are just the business prevention department or the business depressants and so on. But apparently this was quite a strong sentiment which describes why, as part of these failures, risk cultures were perceived to be very weak. This is Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers, with Dick Fuld being named and shamed by outraged employees and media people. I use them as an example because this is 2008, I think, the fall of Lehman Brothers. In 2006, Madeleine Antoncic, who was the chief risk officer of Lehman Brothers, got the Risk Manager Award of the Year from Risk Magazine. Okay. So this just highlights that Madeleine Antoncic had an excellent pedigree. She is a PhD in financial risk management. She had experience in CDOs and so on. She had everything it took to be a CRO. But when important decisions were being made, Dick Fuld sent her out of the executive management room. So essentially, this story talks about Mike Power's definition of a strong risk culture. It wouldn't have happened there. But of course, we didn't have the means of knowing it from her pedigree. A different view that coexisted at this time with the just do it approach to risky decisions came from NASA, which had its long tortured road to this recognition that actually it is important to think carefully about the kind of risks that they were taking. So this is the de facto chief risk officer of Gentry Lee, with whom Bob Kaplan and I had a long-standing research relationship. We wrote a case study on the risk management approach they had here. And it has been staring in our face for a long time, this principle that he essentially articulated the countervailing principle to the hidden hand. That at the beginning of the project, try to write down everything you can that is risky, then put together a plan for each of those risks and watch how the plan evolves. It's a very different approach to risky projects, and it took us some time to realize that this is not just there by accident. This is there because this is the force that's needed to counter some very dysfunctional biases and hindrances to slow thinking about risk management. So we kind of realize that what Gentry Lee is presenting us with is the countervailing principle to the hiding hand, which could be another way of defining risk culture in action, that corporates, by which the corporate risk practices should be guided, if they are to be defined as strong. Which means that when managers are systematically overconfident about their strategies and projects, early identification and discussion of the risks is required. Not because because the regulators tell so, but because it is a painful exercise, because it's necessitated by psychological biases that have now been very strongly documented and suggest that in the face of risk decisions, people tend to revert to system one, fast thinking, and not to system two, slow thinking, careful thinking. So you actually are facing psychological biases that operate both at an individual level and both at organizational level that will make us be very bad at making decisions about risks. This is the sort of psychological background to this idea that effective risk management, therefore, needs to move against these biases. Other than, if not, then we are just embracing the biases. Now, as a result of this, you could define risk management as a collection of intrusive, interactive, using Bob Simons' term, and inquisitive processes that somehow try to go against these biases, and in that case they would have certain characteristics that we defined in our paper based on a large, a 12 company sample where people were trying to do explicitly this. So you might define risk culture again as the kind of formal processes, inquisitive, intrusive, and interactive processes that enable individuals in organizations to activate this system to thinking about risks. Now, in this area, know that there is very little debate around whether this is a good thing or not good thing. Policymakers, regulators think this is good, companies should embrace it. But this comes with a caveat emptor. We don't have the actual empirical evidence that by doing so, organizations will actually perform better. We have lots of assertions from consulting companies who see this happening, but we don't have rigorous empirical research, so this is also a kind of call for research that management accountants can probably carry out and try to figure out, see these practices, see what makes them intrusive in the sense that the revealing hand would require, and whether they work the ways we anticipate, and probably be careful that there will be some unanticipated consequences as well that we need to understand. So there are lots of questions that could be asked around risk management defined as the revealing hand. Now, there will be other challenges as well. One of those is an insight that comes from the man-made disaster literature. When you look at the man-made disasters that we have been seeing, say, in the last 10 years, in none of those cases could it be said that the risk that blew up in the face of the organization was unknown. The information about those issues actually was present in the organization, but not being acted upon. In most cases, the information was even present to decision makers who could have done something, but they didn't. So the question becomes, it's not enough. Actually, maybe we are dealing with the lesser of two problems when we are focusing on risk identification. The bigger problem is, once you know there is a risk in a plethora of risks, what does it take to act upon it? So the problem is not so much risk identification by now, it is the problem of inaction, or knowing when to trigger action. And that is inherent in organizations because of the pluralism that tends to be around the perception of risks. So I'm going to move to the other sort of definition, the other layer of risk culture, which is around having an organizational consciousness of the pluralism of values and objectives at stake in risk management decisions, and sort of having a sense of what would be the trade-off that the organization would make if, say, it had to compromise on one at the expense of other. I wanted to illustrate my point that one of the reasons why pluralism is essential to the risk culture debate is that probably no organization has got just one risk culture. Because of the pluralism of risk perceptions that is well documented in the literature, there are bound to be multiple risk cultures even in the same organization. So to illustrate that, I'll just put in one representation of this coming from 2000. This is one that I like, that my students can relate to, and for which you can find lots of examples from the press. The problem is, though, that, you know, using the simplistic examples, you would just say, okay, the tough guy macho culture describes the investment bank. But actually, any investment bank would probably have a combination of all of these risk subcultures. So this is just to illustrate that when I think about the cases that I know a little bit better, maybe I could be convinced that JPL is tending towards the better company culture, like any other big aerospace R&D organization. But certainly Hydro One, which is an electricity company, has got a combination of all of these subcultures. So this makes the risk culture debate a little bit more complex, because now we are dealing with a multiplicity of risk perceptions and risk subcultures. And this is natural. This is not dysfunctional. This is what we would expect, especially after the good work carried out by the cultural theorists and the relational theorists of risk. So it's completely legitimate and expected that organizations would have multiple perceptions of not only what is at risk, but what threatens it. And then again, there would be multiple perceptions about the cause-effect relationships. So going back for one more note to Ed Schein, it will be very difficult to ever see an integrated risk culture in the Schein sense of culture as an integrated phenomenon. So we would expect many risk subgroups instead. So this sort of brings the idea that maybe the revealing hand of risk management should extend not only to the risks threatening the achievement of strategies, business model objectives, but also the values that are at risk. Okay, so let me illustrate this. There are several examples for this, but I guess in the financial crisis, many investment banks, well, the investment banks who felt that the CDO market is about to collapse, or it has never had any potential of becoming the game changer that it seemed to be, some of these banks decided to create the big short, right? To bet against the market. Now, there are two reasons why a bank might do this. One is that a client might come to them and ask them to create the opportunity to bet against the market, in which case the investment bank has to find clients who would take the other side of the short bet. then some banks who felt that the market is going to collapse felt tempted to go by their proprietary interest and say, we could make that bet as well. So they would go in with an investor and they would also put money in into the short, into the big short, making it even bigger. Then the question becomes, well, now we have to find a client dumb enough to take the other side of this bet. So this presents a conflict of interest for the investment bank, which is trading the interests of different types of clients. How can you privilege every client if in this transaction one is going to win and the other is going to lose? And also it's privileging its own proprietary interest when it makes a decision that rather than just getting out and going neutral in this risk area, it's going to take a positive risk, a positive bet. So we think that, I guess, this decision probably in most cases would have been considered based on the financial aspects of risk taking. What are the risks of going this way, that way, and so on? Probably very little consideration was given to the values stakeholder groups at stake. Of course, I can't say this based on any empirical evidence. We just have the kind of the outrage that we experience in the aftermath of the financial crisis when investors are saying, or who were at the wrong end of these bets, that these banks kind of defrauded them as a result of the conflicts of interest. And so in that sense, these decisions were morally deficient because the bank didn't honor the values that the others expected of it. So from this perspective, it's probably time for me to show you something that Bob Simons has been working on. And so his work since the belief systems is going more and more towards the idea of core value-based decision making, where basically he's kind of, not explicitly but implicitly, embraces the idea that organizations are defined by what risk they leave unattended and what risk get immediate attention and action. And these kind of decisions are probably motivated by some strong sense of core values. He uses the example of Merck and the Vioxx scandal when Merck took a $27 billion hit on withdrawing a drug that they considered 18 months after FDA approval as riskier than they thought before. The decision to withdraw it was, according to Simons' study, was predicated on Merck executives' commitment to a core value, which is putting patient first, and privileging that over, say, short-term shareholder interest or short-term proprietary interest. By the way, in a similar situation, Pfizer had a similar drug on the market. Pfizer didn't withdraw it from the market, and it could defend it by lots of reasons, but according to Simons, again, their core value is around shareholder value. Now, I don't want to comment anymore on the Simons study. I just would like to highlight that there is now this discussion that risk-taking, sort of more morally conscious risk-taking, should somehow bring core values into the discussions of risks and returns. And that would have the additional benefit of clarifying the conflicts of interest that might be at stake. How to operationalize this is the next big question in this area. And of course, this is where business ethics scholars could also get a say in the debate. Now, just one last thing. If you are interested in one company that's starting to operationalize this, I would suggest you read Rob Quayle's Defining Your Taste for Risk article, a practitioner article. Rob Quayle is now the chief risk officer of Hydro One, a Canadian electricity company that basically operates this risk appetite spider chart, which, when you look at it, is basically doing what I have been talking about, extending the revealing hand of risk management to values at stake. And what the numbers mean is to what extent the firm would be unwilling to make a compromise or willing to make a compromise on an objective or stakeholder group or value that you see there. What are the sacrosanct, untradeable values and what are the ones that we might make a compromise on? They tried to develop a tool around this, which is good news because accounting scholars can study these as well, and try to create a kind of diagnostic that would that managers might, and they claim, do use in assessing whether their exhibited risk appetite is in line with the target. So this is just an example to show that there is some tool development taking place in this area. But still, a lot more work is to be done in the area of managerializing risk culture, and so that means that there is a lot, our work is cut out for us to master, so it's going to be an interesting field, and we'll be talking about this for years to come. Thank you.